Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscription, no network, no rules. And at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of the program. We've got an awesome show for you tonight. I'm really, really, really looking forward to this conversation. Our guest is Mark O'Connell, and he is the author of the fantastic book, The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs, and it's the biography of J. Allen Hynek, and I absolutely loved this book. I just cannot put it over enough, folks. Over the years, people have said, I've always said on the show, that I'm more interested in the people, really, than the phenomenon, and as anyone who's listened to the show for years knows, I've been begging Stan Friedman to write a biography, an autobiography, for years and years and years, and Stan keeps putting me off. So thankfully, somebody came along and wrote an equally compelling, if not more fascinating biography of a major key integral player to the world of UFOs, and educated me on a lot of stuff, because I fancy myself a UFO history buff, but I really learned so much from this book, The Close Encounters Man. I cannot put it over enough, folks. It's one of the best UFO books I've read in a long, long time, and suffice to say, easily the best UFO book that's come out this year. I mean, it's outstanding. So congratulations, sir. Thank you for writing this book, because it's tremendous. I loved it. I really did love it. I cannot wait to dig into this with you.
Well, thanks for the kind words. I really appreciate it. And I have to say, it was a labor of love. I'm really proud of the book, and I'm really glad that people are reacting so positively to it.
Oh, it's awesome. And it's sorely needed for right now, as we'll get into later. So the messages of the book, I think, are just, I'm hoping that, like, people who aren't necessarily UFO fans will pick it up and read it, because the messages in the book about the phenomenon, I think, are integral to, the kind of messages we want people to know about. It's like, we don't know the answer to this stuff yet, so we just want to give it a fair shake. It's like, I found myself in a real alignment with Hynek about that. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of the book, give folks a little background. Who is Mark O'Connell, and what led you to writing this book?
Well, I am a writer and college professor living in southern Wisconsin. I have been a science fiction fan my entire life, going back to literally my first conscious memory. Do you want to hear about it? It's kind of a funny story. When I was about 3 years old, my mom, for some odd reason, on a Saturday night, tuned in to a new TV show called The Outer Limits. And there was an alien in that show that scared my little 3-year-old self to death. And I remember running upstairs out of the rec room and just hiding around the corner and saying, I'm not coming out until that monster goes away. So that kind of set the tone for my life. I've just always been fascinated by space and aliens and UFOs and rockets. And then a little later in life, my mom is the culprit. She worked as a librarian at our local library. And she would bring me in with her sometimes when she worked, and I would always gravitate towards It was a small library, but there was one bookshelf that had the books about, you know, they had the Eric Von Daniken and the Brad Steiger and the books about UFOs and poltergeists
and
Bigfoot and the Bermuda Triangle.
I know that
and,
show.
And I just always went straight for that shelf, and I just devoured those books. And so that led to, much later, led to in my 30s, getting my first professional screenwriting gig with Star Trek The Next Generation. That was in the early 90s. And so I did one episode for Next Generation, and that led to four more episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. So that was a really fun gig while that lasted. And a few years ago, fast forward to just a few years ago, maybe 2011, I was kind of casting around for a new writing project. I had a new agent who was bugging me to come up with something fun to write. And I started thinking about UFOs again. I hadn't really thought about them much for a few years. And I thought, hey, there's a lot going on. I should sort of reengage, see what's going on in UFO world, and maybe start writing something about it. So that's really what brings me to today. I started writing a UFO blog called High Strangeness, and just having fun with it. It's a little bit tongue in cheek. I didn't want to be super serious in my blog. I wanted to just have fun with it. A lot of people seem to respond to that positively. So, but here's the thing. I know you experience this in coming up with topics for shows. When you're doing a blog, you have to be coming up with new material constantly.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah. So I was scouring the internet weekly for interesting UFO stories to write about. And one day, lo and behold, I came across the website for KUFOS, the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, in Chicago. Well, I happened to be living in Chicago at the time, and this place was just literally just like 5 or 6 miles from where I lived. So I contacted the scientific director, Mark Rodiger, and sort of invited myself over to poke through their files, and Mark very graciously had me over and sort of gave me run of it's all of Dr. Hynek's legacy of his UFO work is in Mark's basement and another person's basement in Skokie. So I started visiting Mark's basement on a regular basis, looking for fun things to write about, and I always found fun things to write about. And on one of those visits, Mark and I were talking, and he said, "You know, we've always been at the center. We've always hoped we could find someone to write the definitive account of Dr. Hynek's career." And I just raised my hand immediately and said, "Please, I'd love to do it. Please let me do it."
Yeah.
And he said, "Okay, well." Okay, go for it. Here are the files. So, and the way it worked out was just beautiful because I had Dr. Hynek's UFO work in all these files in Mark's basement and his colleague Mary Kastner's basement. But then I also had Hynek's archives from his career as an astronomer and an educator at Northwestern University, which was just a few miles in the other direction in Chicago. So I started going to the University Archives at Northwestern, and they just had boxes and boxes and boxes of Hynek's correspondence and his professional papers and speeches. And so I got really lucky because all of Hynek's archives were all right in my neighborhood. So it just kind of, you know, it sort of fell in my lap, and then it just sort of came together magically, this whole story.
Well, it's tremendous stuff, man. I loved it. It's hard for me almost to – it's like, where do you begin? Because usually we do an episode like this. So it's like, all right, let's do a thumbnail on Hynek's life. But the book is Hynek's life. It's really – there's so many elements to it. I have a lot of notes here, and we'll kind of get into them. You were saying about finding new ideas for stuff. There was part of me after I read the book where I was thinking to myself that if you're ever looking for another book idea, I'd love to see you sort of flesh out that beginning – before Hynek's born, when like people are convinced that Mars has life, and like the New York Times is running stuff that's like clearly Mars is populated by people, and it's like because I'm reading that and my jaw's like on the ground where it's like, ah, oh, there really was a time. You know.
Yeah, wasn't that?
It's like we're trying to get back there, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what I wanted to do, and so you're talking about the prologue of the book, and
yeah, yeah.
What I wanted to do with the prologue was, number one, I wanted to establish that we've always been fascinated with the idea of life on other planets. We need to believe in aliens. I'm not sure why, but I think we need to believe in aliens. So I just wanted to establish that this belief has been really core to the human experience going back a long, long, long way. But I also wanted to establish, secondly, that that Dr. Hynek's birth was really just one part of that whole continuum.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And like I said, I'm trying not to sort of have us go chronologically, I guess you could say, through the book. What I find interesting, and as you point out about his academic work, the book's really interesting in that sense because nowadays, Hynek's kind of been lost to history in general because UFOs are like completely verboten and they're in a weird like realm. I find, unfortunately, with the exception of like the real hardcore, like people like me and folks who listen to the show and that kind of stuff, it's like people don't know the history of this stuff. And like I said, I fancied myself a UFO history buff, but then when I read the book, I learned so much more. Well, I was like, wow, this is what I like about the book is that it's like an evolution of his thinking about the phenomenon. And it kind of gives you almost a glimpse into what other people probably were thinking at the time, too. It's like, it's just like people were, they were genuinely baffled by this and considering it, which is so different than how it is today.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny. A lot of times I'm asked the same question, and that is, when did Dr. Hynek change his mind about UFOs? And I always kind of laugh when I'm asked that question because I have to say, well, as you just alluded to, there wasn't any one magic moment when a light bulb went off above Dr. Hynek's head and he said, hey, wait a minute, I need to start taking these UFOs seriously. It was a process. It really took place over many, many years in his life, and he had to jump through a lot of, you know, mental hoops to get there, to get to where he could, you know, admit to himself and to the world that he really thought there was something going on there, which to me, that made him a really fascinating character.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I noticed that in the book. I was trying, as I was reading the book, I was kind of trying to find that swing moment, and as you say, it sort of evolves over time. What I thought was interesting, and it's funny because I nabbed it in the book when I'm reading it, I have it underlined, and then it's like the last line of the book. At one point you're talking about how he's changing his mind on the Ken Mantell case, and his sort of rationalization for this was that this had been 4 years earlier. This is so he's thinking to himself, like, he's starting to have doubts about whether that there may be something to it. And his whole sort of line of thinking is that, well, in 47, when this first started, I thought it was just some crazy fad. But it's still going on 4 years later. And I think the line is, like, it persists. This phenomenon persists. And so, therefore, there's got to be something going on here. This isn't just some crazy fad. And I thought that was really interesting. As I said, clearly you did too, because you finished the book with that line. That should be like the clarion call of the UFO, enthusiast. So this persists. We need to, enough's enough. Let's look at it. It's still happening, you know?
Yeah, and the way I frame it in the book is that's the one fact about UFOs that nobody can deny and that nobody can explain. Why does it still keep happening? Nobody can explain that. People can make all sorts of attempts to explain this, that, or the other thing about the UFO phenomenon, and they generally fail. But this is the one thing you generally cannot explain, is why is it still happening?
Right, exactly. And as you said beautifully just then, it's like we can point to that. You know, we can point to that's the one thing. We don't know anything else.
Yeah, exactly.
Except that it's been happening and it keeps happening, you know?
Yeah.
And that should in a sense be enough to convince people that it's worth taking a look at. But it's maddening in a sense. That's kind of like, I love the book. At times it drove me crazy. It's sort of in a FOMO sense. I feel like I missed out. It was like, I wish I had. It sounds like such a more exciting era for UFOs because they were taken seriously. Because people, you know, that was, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. That was like their first impression on the world. And it was really fascinating to see people grappling with it when today it's, the question of UFOs is so stale, you know. It's like there's no excitement around it anymore. Back then it was like people were genuinely excited about it and talked about it. People on the street. It was like it was fascinating.
Yeah, and instead of all the cable TV shows about UFOs, there were all sorts of magazines and paperbacks about UFOs that you know were immensely popular.
Right, exactly. I think you mentioned at one point, like Life magazine has like a cover story on UFOs, and it's like, oh my God, this is. It's like,
yeah,
oh
they took
man,
it seriously.
Yeah. Now, forgive me. Sometimes I don't necessarily throw a question out at you. I'm kind of just jamming with you here because just sort of talking
that's fine.
About my
this
observer,
is fun.
All right, good. Because I don't want, like I said, I don't want to be like. So in 1972, what did Kynick mean by And I guess one misconception that kind of cleared up for me via the book was the, I guess, as I said, most people don't know their UFO history very well anyway. And it's like the old idea is kind of like that Hynek worked in cahoots with Blue Book. That like that he was, you know, that he was sort of an insider with Blue Book. Obviously he was. But like that he was actively trying to suppress this stuff. And I get the impression from the book that really wasn't the case. It was more, and you have a great thing that I guess influenced Hynek that he kept saying, the Kepler story about how Kepler had to work with this really gruesome dude and needed access to his data. So Kepler put up with it and so he could get the data. That was Hynek's rationalization. Kepler was his hero.
Yeah.
That he had to deal with this Blue Book stuff in order to get the UFO files, because nobody else who was willing to give it a fair shake was going to be able to get it. And I think at one point he rationalized that to somebody or explained that to somebody. He's like, if they get rid of me, if I don't play ball and they get rid of me, they're going to get some guy who's totally going to play ball, and we're never going to get any look at any of this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So in that sense, Hynek kind of sacrificed himself for the cause, you know?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Because he remained in this situation working for the Air Force where he knew he was going to be subject to constant criticism, and yet he stuck with it because the data, having access to those files, was more important than his personal feelings or his personal reputation. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's sort of, in a sense, the book vindicates him, I think, from that urban legend, I guess you'd call it, or something. You know what I mean? It's like the misconception. It's like, no, dude, he wasn't like, he had no ill intent, folks. He wasn't a skeptic or a debunker. He was a scientist who was trying to look at this stuff. And as luck would have it, he happened to live near where the initial study was going on. It's not even like they recruited him just because he lived down the street or something like that or nearby.
Yeah, yeah. I like the way you put it, that he had no ill intent. I think that's a really nice way of putting it. He really didn't. He didn't have an axe to grind, you know. He just wanted a scientific study of the phenomenon, which is really not asking all that much. But it was a constant mission throughout life, and you know, he came close and he never quite got there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of obvious that you're a screenwriter because the story, like, it's like a really – it moves like a story, the book, I mean. And it's like you see
–
you know, I can kind of imagine the scene, like, when they agree to the Condon Committee and he's, like, celebrating and he thinks this is the turning point. But it's like we know at least I knew, you know, the reader knows, if they know UFO history, it's like, no, dude, this is going to be bad. Like, this is going to be terrible, dude. Stop celebrating. It's yeah, it's a very dramatic sort of moment. Yeah, so let me see where well, to get back to the Blue Book in a sense, I thought this was interesting. It jumped out at me. It's a small detail, but I think it's important. During the D.C. sightings, because people talk about, oh, well, maybe the good cases didn't go to Blue Book and stuff like that. That seems to be the indication, at least as a slight clue, in that when these crazy D.C. sightings were happening over the Capitol, Ruppelt, who was running Blue Book, couldn't even get in. They wouldn't let him investigate as it was unfolding. And it's like, that really stands out as weird.
It does. And, you know, the only possible explanation I can imagine for why he would have been kept away is that the CIA was becoming involved. And that, you know, and that maybe the CIA pulled a power play and said, no, we're not giving this to the Air Force. We're going to look at this ourselves. That's, you know, to me, that makes sense. I can't think of any other reason why Captain Ruppelt would have been held back from investigating this huge, huge case when he's right there at ground zero as it's happening.
Yeah.
And yet he's basically sent packing back to Wright-Patterson in Ohio. Yeah, that's a crazy story. And, you know, Hynek did, and I mentioned in the book, later in the book, that, you know, Hynek did often have these experiences where someone would approach him and say, hey, do you remember the report I filed with Blue Book? And they would describe their UFO experience, and Hynek would say, well, no, I never saw that. And the person would say, are you sure? Because I know it was submitted to Blue Book. So those kinds of incidents would make Hynek think, okay, so some of the good cases are not coming to the Blue Book offices. Some of these good cases are being routed somewhere else. Where they were going, we may never know.
Yeah, we never did find out either. Yeah, yeah.
No,
like
he certainly never found out.
Yeah, yeah. It's very, very interesting in a sense. It's I thought it was cool too. Sort of around the same time that's going on in the book, he's working for the Air Force. It's Project Stork, which I confuse all these, but it was Project Stork. I don't remember exactly what the aim of that one was, but it was sort of like one of these UFO study groups by the Air Force, but they have Hynek go out and like not infiltrate, but just hang out with astronomers, because he was like an esteemed, nationally known, you know, esteemed astronomer who I assume at the time really wasn't tagged with UFOs yet. So it's like, so he's just kind of hanging out with astronomers at different universities trying to gauge their take on UFOs. So to me, that was another part of the book where it was like, this is fascinating historically. You talk about, like, government interference and stuff like that. It's like, it's not necessarily government interference, but it's spying almost. It's like spy work. It's very weird, but cool.
Well, that's certainly the way he approached it. He says he did his best cloak and dagger routine interview because he didn't want the astronomers to know that he was formally surveying them for his boss. You know, he just wanted to make it part of a casual conversation so he could, you know, just sort of elicit people's honest responses to his questions. And that was a fascinating period because this took place right after Project Blue Book was formed in the wake of Project Grudge being canceled. That all gets complicated.
Yeah.
But Project Blue Book was the new version of the Air Force's UFO study. Captain Edward Ruppelt was put in charge, and he was a pretty interesting and a pretty fair-minded guy when it came to UFOs. And he contracted with Battelle Memorial Institute in Dayton, Ohio, to conduct some studies that were beyond the scope of the meager staff that Blue Book had. He contracted with Battelle to do studies of basically what makes a person, how does a person experience a UFO sighting? How can we separate the knowns from the unknowns? Can we find any patterns in the UFO data that we've already collected? So Battelle Memorial, in turn, subcontracted Dr. Hynek to do a part of that study. So Hynek's part of that was to do this survey of astronomers. And as you said, he traveled all around the country. He interviewed about 50 of his colleagues. And he found that about, if I'm remembering the number right, I don't have it in front of me, I believe, but it was about 10% of the astronomers he surveyed took the UFO phenomenon seriously and thought that it was worthy of study. But generally, they did not want to be publicly associated with it. So they thought it was great that Hynek wanted to study UFOs, and they would help if they could, but they didn't want to do it publicly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very – you wonder what the – you wonder what those numbers are like nowadays, because it's – like I said, it's changed so much. I guess this is kind of like – it's sort of, in a sense, a question of sort of like when he changed his mind. But it's like you might have a better – you might be able to pin this down a little bit, I guess. It's like when did he – I guess when did he kind of become known as the UFO guy? Like to – I guess essentially first to his colleagues, and I think the public kind of like picked up on it with the swamp gas thing. But like when did – when was he within the fraternity of astronomers? When was it like – Was it always kind of a secret that he was working with Blue Book, or did it kind of like get around eventually?
I think it was. I don't know if secret may be too strong a word, but I think it probably wasn't very well known. It was. I mean, at the time, if you look at it in the right context, it was really just another research contract between a university and the military.
Right.
You know, this is fairly commonplace. In this case, the U.S. Air Force contracted with Dr. Hynek through the Ohio State University, for whom he was working at the time. So to all intents and purposes, it was just a run-of-the-mill research contract between a university and the Air Force.
Right.
So it didn't really raise any eyebrows or anything. But Hynek kind of broke cover in the early 1950s. And again, this is pretty early in the game for him. So I was surprised to find that he was talking openly about UFOs so early in his career. But in 1952, and this is right around the time he did the survey of the astronomers as well, then he attended a meeting of the Optical Society of America, a scientific association in Boston. And the society did something a little radical at this meeting. They invited three scientists to present papers on the UFO phenomenon. And two of the scientists got up on stage and basically trashed UFOs. And then the third scientist was none other than J. Allen Hynek, who, you know, basically nobody knew who he was at the time. He was just a junior, you know, probably an associate professor at that point at Ohio State University. So Hynek gets up on stage in front of a gathering of his fellow scientists. And first of all, he chides the first two speakers for being so closed-minded. But then he goes ahead and says, I know a little bit about this subject because for the past couple of years, I've been working for the Air Force, debunking UFO cases. So he says, I know what's going on, and I know that there is, by this time, Hynek had identified that there was this 20% consistent, 20% residue of cases that could not be explained. So he goes in front of these scientists and says, hey, this may sound silly to you, but I'm telling you, there's something going on here, and I think we ought to pay attention to it. So that was really the first time that Hynek stuck his neck out and publicly, you know, spoke about this to scientists.
Mm.
But you asked about how he became known to the public. That did come. That came much later, and it came, you know, in fits and starts. Of course, in 1957, Hynek was famous for a while because of the whole Sputnik situation.
Mm.
So you know, he was recognized. He was recognized in the public. He was the pioneer who set up the first satellite tracking system, global satellite tracking system. So he had risen to a certain level of fame in scientific circles. But then, we get into the early 60s and we start having cases like, as you mentioned, the swamp gas case in 66. That was the time period when Hynek really started to become well known among the general public.
Yeah. See, that's why I love this, because I just love this book so much, because you hit on stuff that I remember now reading in the book, but I didn't put the notes. See, there's a whole, like, great story about how Hynek was involved with they were going to launch the first American satellite, and then all of a sudden the Russians scooped us up, you know, beat us to the punch, and they launched Sputnik, and it was crazy, and Hynek had to sort of really he was on in overdrive here on this, dealing with this issue, and,
yeah.
And became, as Mark said, he became like a national celebrity, you know, in a sense where you'd see a scientist on TV today, when he had nothing to do with UFOs. There's a whole part of the book. It's like his life. There's a big part of his life that had nothing to do with UFOs that he was integral in the scientific field for. It's really amazing. Again, it's like, it's annoying in a sense because it's like, just because he was the UFO guy, you don't hear about all these great scientific achievements either.
Yeah. Yeah, that whole Sputnik story was one of my favorite stories when I was doing the research. Because you mentioned that made him a celebrity, and that's true, but it also, more than a celebrity, it made him sort of a voice of reassurance to the American public. Because people were freaking out over Sputnik, you know, from coast to coast. Americans were terrified because we thought this meant that the Russians could attack us from space at any time. So Hynek became, along with his boss Fred Whipple at the Harvard Smithsonian Observatory, the two of them, Hynek and Whipple, became sort of these faces and voices of reassurance because they got on TV and they got on radio and said, no, 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 we're not under attack. It's a little 10-pound metal ball that's orbiting the Earth. That's all there is to it. It can't hurt us in any way. And like I mentioned in the book, this is the other cool thing. It's not just that Hynek was the only scientist who knew about satellites who could talk about this to the media when the night Sputnik was launched. It's that he was literally the only scientist at his desk when the call came out, the news came out that the Russians had launched the satellite. Hynek is like the only man on Earth who can explain to the American public what the hell is going on. It's amazing moment in space history.
Absolutely, yeah. And you wonder, like, you just wish in a sense that like things had gone differently, that the ball had gone a different direction, you know, that it had careened off something else. And because he already had that sort of, like, I guess you could say reputation as someone who could reassure the public about something like this. So if there was some kind of breakthrough with UFOs, he could have been the guy to explain this to people, especially based on his prior research into it. You know,
it's just such a lost opportunity,
you know. Let me see here. I'm bouncing around on my notes here on this one. So the American Optical Society, I had that in my notes because I thought, here's a great line, folks, that you can use next time you're dealing with a skeptic, and that's what Hynek said to these two guys, and he said, ridicule is not part of the scientific method. I thought that was such a great line. It's like next time I'm dealing with some psychic making some ridiculous skeptic making some ridiculous jokes about this, it's going to be like, what part of the scientific method is it to make fun of people, dude? That's not, you know, are you doing a serious investigation of this or just making jokes?
Yeah, that is absolutely my favorite Hynek quote out of all of them. So I'm glad you pointed it out.
Yeah, it says a lot. I mean, it really, it says a lot.
It's remarkably, and he said this as, again, this is really early in his career as a ufologist, and he himself, up until that point, he himself had been guilty of, you know, maybe not ridiculing UFO witnesses, but definitely casting doubt on their word, because he had been debunking cases for the airport for the Air Force for a couple of years now. So he was actually, you know, in a sense, referring to himself because he had done the same thing.
Yeah, and perhaps it was sort of like, hindsight being 2020 combined with regret, you know, it's like,
yeah,
because it seemed like in a sense he did. I think he did name a case later that he regretted.
The case in Idaho Falls.
Yeah, this was the police officer, right?
I
was thinking of one where the police officer's life got ruined or something because I think Blue Book dismissed his case and kind of made him out to be
Dale Spar.
Oh god,
yeah, that's a sad story.
Yeah,
definitely a sad story. The one I was thinking about was in the early 50s in Idaho Falls when a man and his two sons saw a metallic saucer, a metallic disc, flying down the Idaho, is it the Snake River Valley?
Yeah.
I can't
yeah.
remember now.
Yeah.
At any rate, so, and Hynek went in and just said, well, Hynek, for that case, for his Air Force report, Hynek actually made up an atmospheric phenomena that didn't even exist. He said in his report that, well, this must have been a rare atmospheric eddy. Well, there's no such thing as an atmospheric eddy. The only reason he came up with it was because the witnesses said that when the flying disc passed these tall trees, they didn't just make the trees sway, they actually made the trees twist. And so Hynek was like, twisting motion, that must be an atmospheric eddy. So that's what he actually put in his report. And several years later, he admitted that, well, that was something he'd actually made up. He had never heard of an atmospheric eddy before. They didn't exist. And he said, in retrospect, that was a complete jerk. He said, I never should have said that about this case. I should have taken the witnesses seriously, and I should have put a lot more thought into it. And I thought one of my big goals in researching in those early years was I had to find, I knew there had to be some case that Hynek regretted where he would publicly admit that he regretted it. And it took months and months and months of looking, and I finally found that case, and I was very happy to see it because, you know, obviously, a moment like that just really humanizes the guy.
Yeah, for sure, because it's really hard to say you were wrong about something. I think that's, you know, a problem that a lot of scientists today have, you know.
Yeah,
it's what's
definitely
kept this thing from breaking through in a lot of ways. All right, let me jump to one I definitely want to talk about, because I know for sure that you'll get into this, because I think you just wrote a blog post about it today or recently. And if there's one, villain that emerges from the book, it's Carl Sagan. I came out
Ooh,
of this
his.
Book. Oh, I came out of this book, dude, hating Carl Sagan. Like, I had kind of always just been nonchalant about the guy. It was like, yeah, he. I guess he was a debunker back in the day, because I was born '79. I got into this like really late, like in the 2000s. So, to me, it's like Hynek, Sagan, Menzel. All these people are like way, way in the past for me. I never really had to deal with watching them and stuff. So, it was like reading the book and. I'm on Hynek's side, obviously. I've grown to love the guy over the course of the book. And then the Sagan just, he just makes me so mad, man. He just makes me so mad. He was sort of like, he's the villain of the book in a lot of ways. I guess talk a little bit, I guess, about sort of his role in the, as the antagonist, as the main, as the main dude who sort of was like the, the antagonist for Hynek. I mean, there's really no other way to put it. It's like every time Hynek shows up at one of these events and stuff, or a lot of these events, it's like the TV shows or debates or conferences, they always seem compelled to bring in Sagan, and it devolves into this battle between the two.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, and it was one of my favorite parts of the book to write. And I have to say, I've always been a huge Carl Sagan fan. I truly have. It was a huge disappointment to me to find out that he had this ugly side to him that came out wherever UFOs came up. When I first came across this, when I was researching in the Kufos files, one of the file drawers contained the letter S, and I saw two file folders that immediately jumped out at me. One said Spielberg and one said Sagan.
Nice.
So those were like... those were two files that really, really got me excited. So I pull out the Sagan file, and I'm looking through it, and they exchanged a whole lot of correspondence over the years, and there's always this very high level of professional respect between the two of them. So on one level, they were fantastic colleagues. You know, they communicated a lot, they respected each other, but in this one area, things went bad. So I found this letter from Dr. Hynek to Carl Sagan from the early, or I guess the mid-70s, in which he talks about an upcoming appearance they're going to make together. And Hynek essentially asks Dr. Sagan to call a truce. He says, could we just stick to the topics we agree on and not get into all this UFO stuff? Because he said it's going to come out wrong because everybody thinks I'm saying that UFOs are a nuts and bolts phenomenon, and I don't believe that. So could we please just not talk about it during this public appearance? And I thought, wow, he's asking Carl Sagan for a truce. What is going on here? So I started digging and digging and came up with you know, three or four, I think, really high-profile instances where Hynek and Sagan clashed in public, and it really got ugly. And one of the best accounts came from the fantastic book Beyond Earth, Man's Contact with UFOs, by Ralph and Judy Blume. It's published back in the 70s or 80s. Really, really fun book. Well, they give the account of this appearance that Dr. Hynek and Dr. Sagan made on the Dick Cavett Show in 1973, right after the Pascagoula, Mississippi abduction and the Coyne helicopter case. And they just recount in vivid detail how Carl Sagan just mocked and ridiculed everybody on stage,
including
Dr. Hynek. And so I was just astounded. I had that book in my collection, Beyond Earth. I had that book for many, many, many years, and I'd completely forgotten about that chapter. I dug and dug, and here's the weird thing. That story with Carl Sagan kind of climaxes with this futurism conference they both attended in 1975, and that's what the truce letter was referring to. So for the longest time, I had that truce letter in my hand, but I did not know the end of the story.
Ah.
And it was driving me nuts because I was coming close to my deadline to turn in the draft of the book. And I still had no idea how the story ended. Well, I just happened to stop in at the Northwestern Archives. This is just one of these little miracles of this book that I just want to share.
Mm-hmm.
I stop in at the Northwestern University Archives because I'm looking for one particular thing. I think I was looking for photos that day. And the archivist, Kevin, says, hey, Mark, I've got something you might be interested in. And he takes me over to this computer console in another room. And he says, we just got done digitizing our entire collection of the Daily Northwestern campus newspaper. And he said, now wait a minute, let me do a search. And he goes, I'm going to search for Hynek's name. And he said, whoa, Hynek's name comes up like 318 times in this whole collection of the campus newspaper. So I sat down at this terminal and I started looking through all 318 entries. And I found an entry that talked about this futurism conference coming up at which Dr. Hynek would be speaking along with Dr. Sagan.
Yeah.
And suddenly I had the key to this story, and I used that information. Using that information of where and when this futurism conference was going to take place, I found an article that appeared in a 1980 UFO magazine in which they had a reporter at this conference who documented this battle royale between Sagan and Hynek. And it's an incredible story, and Carl Sagan comes off as a complete jerk, and Hynek comes off as, you know, a totally decent and totally respectful, questioning, open-minded scientist. And it was the perfect ending to the story. It kind of brought it to its head and just really kind of established who these two men were and established, you know, how hard it is to get someone to change it, especially a scientist, to change his mind about something.
Yeah, but what I thought was interesting in a sense, too, was like, I mean, and I'm sure there's a lot of debate about the nature of Sagan and was he, you know, in cahoots with the government and that kind of stuff. Because to me, everything he did with Hynek, as far as like when they would debate this stuff in public, and you pointed out in the book, was really like dirty, underhanded in a sense. Because They would get into this debate sort of format, and Hynek's whole argument, as you mentioned from the truce letter, was like, Hynek was like, I don't know, I'm not saying these are aliens, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm just saying we should try and figure it out. And but Sagan wouldn't debate that argument with him. Sagan would only go from the direction of, it's silly to say these are aliens.
Right.
And it was so, like, reading sort of the exchanges between them in these different settings is maddeningly frustrating, because it's like dude, would you just cut the BS, man? Like,
yeah.
and talk about this issue on equal footing with Hynek, or are you just going to play these games? And it's like the same. You see the same stuff from skeptics today. You know, it's like they can't have a straight up conversation about this. They have to play games.
Right. And for me, one of the real disappointments of that whole Carl Sagan story was when I started finding all these accounts of these confrontations that he and Dr. Hynek had. You know, my first impression was that their differences of opinion stemmed from differences in scientific philosophy. But that's not true. It wasn't that high-minded at all. It all came down to money.
Mm.
Carl Sagan hated the idea that one penny of research money should go to UFO research, because
right.
that would be a penny that he wouldn't get for his planetary research. That's what it all really came down to for Carl Sagan. It was all about money. He did not want J. Allen Hynek to have one penny of research money given to him.
Exactly. And honestly, another sort of thing that bubbled up from reading the book was, you make a point that was Sagan's argument. It's wasted money on all this stuff. And if you look back now, you point this out in the book, it's like SETI has been going on for like 30 years. They've probably wasted billions of dollars on this.
Yep.
If you put 10, why not give 10% of that money to UFO studies?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. How hard would that be?
It is
frustrating.
It really is. It really is. And like I said, the book is, and it's no fault of Hynek. He was the one trying to change this, the way things turned out. But it's like,
yeah.
the whole book is this series of like missed opportunities. It's like, oh
yes.
man, you know, because you mentioned when the Condon report comes out, and how, and this is another sort of thing that stood out to me that I had never known or realized, that was actually kind of a golden age for ufology. That
yeah.
more people, because I always look back on it as that was what killed ufology, killed a serious look at UFOs from the establishment, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
But you kind of make a point in the book that even though Condon, you know, put the kibosh on UFOs from a government perspective, it sort of opened the eyes of a lot of scientists.
Yeah, and you know, and in large part, it was because the conclusions of the Condon report were so ridiculous, and it was evident to almost anybody who read the final report, because the entire report builds up a case for the possibility, at least, that UFOs are a real phenomenon and they're worthy of study. And then the final chapter is written by Edward Condon, and he just squashes the entire report, and he says, no, this is a bunch of crap. There's nothing here. We're
yeah.
done. And yeah, you would think that would have killed ufology, but it had a reverse effect with Dr. Hynek, because it led to the cancellation of Project Blue Book, first of all.
Mm.
But once Hynek was free of the constraints of working with the Air Force, he could actually start, you know, speaking his mind and going his own way with UFO research. So for him, you know, ultimately it was very liberating.
Yeah, it seemed that way. It seemed that way because, as you say in the book, then he started pursuing a whole bunch of sort of like more fringy type stuff that even his friends were like, "Whoa, what are you doing, man?" But
yeah,
he was willing to like look at even stranger stuff. There's so many elements of the book that I really love, because it's like a part of the book too is he's sort of trying to come to grips with this UFO thing. It's so hard, like in this modern age, to put your mind back to the way people thought back then. But you know,
yeah.
he's struggling with this stuff, and then oh no! All of a sudden, here come human, here come aliens, here come the people on the craft. Like things are happening. All of a sudden, there's cases now with these things, and you know, he didn't know what to do about that. He wasn't really sure, you know, what to think.
Yeah, it was an interesting part of his story. I thought that you know, here's the guy who developed the close encounters categorization system that includes close encounters of the third kind, which
mm-hmm.
is very specific about the involvement of, you know, but occupants,
there you go.
Entities associated with the UFO. So, you know, Hynek felt he had to include that, but he hated the fact that he had to include that in his system.
yeah.
Because he was never truly comfortable with with the idea of entities associated with this phenomenon. I mean, his thinking changed a little, as I point out in the book. You know, after he went to Australia and Papua New Guinea and talked with Father Gill and the witnesses to the Gill close encounter case, and then he came back home from that case and he met Calvin Parker and Charles Hickson in Pascagoula, Mississippi, right after their abduction. And also along in there, you know, he met Barney and Betty Hill and had a chance to interview them under hypnosis. So those experiences at least started to help him become more open-minded about the possibility of entities.
Yeah.
But it was always a struggle for him, always.
I can imagine, yeah, yeah. Because nowadays, we these stories are part and parcel with the phenomenon. But like back then, it was like I said, it's like what? You know?
Yeah, exactly. It just seemed so crazy.
Yeah.
That it was to even mention it just brought instant ridicule and disbelief.
Yeah. Right, right. Especially because if you're trying to take this seriously, you want to like, from his point of view, and even today, it's like you want to divorce it from the entity aspect of it.
Yeah.
You want to be like, let's just look at the crazy UFO, the F part, you know, the flying saucer part, you know, we'll worry about what's in them once we know for sure that they exist.
Yeah.
So very, very remarkable stuff. And what I thought was really cool, it's a double-edged sword. It's another thing that kind of breaks my heart reading the book. It's like you talk about these three cases just I know they were sort of separated by time, the Gill case and the Pascagoula case and the Hill case, but it's like there's no – there hasn't been like an iconic case, maybe, Stephenville, Phoenix Lights, so that gives us 20 years really,
yeah.
You know. There hasn't been an iconic case at all, and it's heartbreaking in two ends because there's no iconic cases, and back then when these iconic cases were happening, he was going to them.
Yeah.
That was really cool to me. It's like the Pascagoula thing happens, it gets in the news, and he's on a plane, he's down to Pascagoula to find out what happened. It's like, that's awesome, man. I wish there was like a genuine, legit scientist who, I wish there were more iconic cases happening, maybe that's because there isn't a guy going down and looking at them immediately as it happens. You know,
yeah,
first response thing is like, wow.
Yeah, and not only that, but not only is he literally a first responder, but all of the reporters that have gathered in Pascagoula, Mississippi, they all want to talk to him because they know he's the guy who's going to explain this to us. You know, nobody else, just Hynek.
Right. It's really, it's an incredible glimpse of a world of UFOs that like, just does not exist anymore, you know.
Yeah.
It's just
I really enjoyed writing about the Pascagoula case because that case is really personally special to me because at the beginning of the show I told you all about my childhood and my upbringing and how I became interested in all this. When the Pascagoula abduction took place in October 1973, I was 13 years old then. And I vividly remember what a big deal that story was. I heard about it on the radio. We always had a radio on in my house, so we always got the news on the radio. They were talking about it on the radio news. They were talking about it on the TV news. There were articles in the newspaper about this case where these two men were apparently abducted by weird entities and taken aboard a UFO. That was the first time that a UFO incident became real, like immediately real to me, because up till then I had just been reading about them in books. You know, it was like history, and here's this case. It's not history. It's just happened, and people are taking it seriously, and everybody's talking about it, and a lot of people are scared and freaking out over this. So to me, that case was kind of like the eye opener. That was the case where I realized, oh wow. This is real stuff. These are real people. This isn't just stories in a book.
Well, to break away, I guess, in a sense from your book and sort of just get a little bit speculative, like why do you, because you've done your homework on this UFO stuff, you know what you're talking about, you know? So what, I'm interested in your perspective on this. Like why do you think there are no iconic cases anymore?
Well, It kind of make when I wonder about things like that, it kind of makes me wonder whether there is some conscious, deliberate motive that we can ascribe to the phenomenon itself. It's almost as if the phenomenon has decided to pull back and go back into hiding for some reason. And I can't explain that. I know, because what I'm saying is I'm assuming that there is an intelligence behind the phenomenon, which, of course, cannot be proven. But it certainly seems like there could be an intelligence behind the phenomenon. So for me, I just sort of look at behavior, and I think, well, maybe they, you know, maybe they've changed their methods. They still seem to be, you know, giving out information in some way, but they seem to be changing their methods. It's funny because I just did an interview this morning, of all things, on a radio station in Dublin, Ireland.
Oh wow!
And the host of the show started talking about, well, now how come, you know, everybody in the world has a camera in their pocket now?
God, I hate that argument. Yeah.
You know, how come we aren't seeing millions and millions of photos of great UFOs? And you know, and my response was, well, you know, if you were the UFOs, wouldn't you take that into account? Wouldn't you just become a million times sneakier and stealthier?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, and I've made the point, and it occurred to me that a week ago, millions of us were looking up in the sky and taking pictures of the eclipse.
Right.
You know, that may have been the moment when the most cameras of all time were pointed at the sky, taking pictures at the exact same time. And did anybody find anything weird on their photos? I had one commenter on my blog who said, you can bet sometime in the next couple of days, people are going to start coming up with eclipse photos that have weird things in them that shouldn't be there. And I haven't heard anything yet, but I certainly think it's possible. So to answer your question, I kind of come to the only conclusion I can come to is that there's some thought behind this, that they're deliberately messing with us. They're deliberately manipulating with us. They're playing with our expectations. They're playing with our fears, obviously. I've used this analogy before. I'm sorry if this is going too far, but I sometimes refer to the old Monty Python sketch called Confuse-a-Cat. Does that ring any bells?
No, it's a little before my time, but all right.
I was afraid of that. Well, you know who Monty Python's Flying Circus is, right?
Of course,
okay,
yeah.
The British comedy troupe. They once did this extremely weird sketch called Confuse-a-Cat. I know this is going to sound ridiculous, but please bear with me. So in this sketch, this man and wife are upset because their cat has just sunk into just a funk. The cat has lost its will to live, apparently. So they call in the vet, and the vet can't do anything. And the vet says, this looks like a case for Confuse-a-Cat. So they call in Confuse-a-Cat, and it's just the Monty Python guys doing – they set up a little stage in front of the cat, and they just start doing all these weird nonsense skits. And after a few minutes of this, the cat gets up and prances away. And everybody says, thank God Confuse-a-Cat saved the cat. And I sometimes think that we are the cat and the UFOs are the Confuse-a-Cat squad. It's almost like they're putting on this bizarre show that makes absolutely no sense, but they're doing it to sort of, you know, to sort of jolt us out of our everyday consciousness and try to get us to think differently or see things differently.
Yeah, I hope that's the case. Yeah.
That's my speech.
Yeah. Well, it's very, just like I said, the book, it makes me pine for a past that, you know, I don't know if it's just my imagination. I'm imposing it because I read the book, but it's like it seems like as Hynek winds down, that's when this seems to wind down as well. That's kind of the remarkable part. I think you even mentioned, like in the book, even by the 80s, there really weren't any, you know, in his last few years, there really weren't any major super cases.
Yeah. I mean, there were a few things like the Hestalen lights. That was a big thing, and you know, the Hudson Valley sightings.
Yep.
So, you know, there were some sightings that still sparked Hynek's interest, but you're right. There wasn't anything really spectacular. anything that really became a global news story. Yeah.
Well, I think there's something to be said if one was going to dig into that sort of transition period. It's like I've often noted that that's when a lot of these sort of subcultures exploded too. You know, it's cattle mutilations, crop circles, abductions, Roswell, all that sort of came, you know, sort of bloomed and burst forth like toward the late 70s and early 80s. So,
you know, that is a weird thing because so Dr. Hynek died in 86. In 87, that's when Whitley Strieber's Communion came out. And that's also when, what's the Intruders? Bud Hopkins, yeah. I'm pretty sure Intruders came out in 1987 also. And, you know, those two books just completely rewrote the book on alien abductions. And they just both happened to come out the year after Hynek passed away. I think that's kind of interesting.
Pardon the interruption, but I'm Mike Wilbon. Tony, more than 30 people in Stephenville, Texas, say they saw a UFO. You believe him?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Tony Kornheiser, believe him. Who do you think was up there getting probed?